to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host today, Greta Anderson, as we continue our Friday series, Clean Water Radio, exploring the waters of Iowa and how they are so much a part of our lives. This summer is certainly one of the most beautiful and pleasant summers I can remember in Central Iowa, and so it is appropriate that today's focus is on paddling Iowa's rivers and soaking in all that green beauty. First, I speak with Jim Pease, well known as a voice for wildlife, about a project he is undertaking for the Iowa DNR to travel rivers all across the state of Iowa and document what he sees. His reports will be written up as brochures for recreational users of the river so that they can deepen their knowledge and appreciation of the experience. After that, we'll hear an interview of Rob Bolke of Roland, Iowa. Just your average paddling enthusiast with 7 canoes in his backyard and 3 to 4 kayaks hanging in his garage. Rob grew up in Dayton, Iowa, within walking distance of the Des Moines River, and has a Huckleberry Finn-like adventure tale from his youth, as well as advice for paddlers in Central Iowa. So without further ado, let's launch this show downstream and see what we can see along the ride. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you much. Glad to be here.
And tell me about this program called the Iowa Rivers Program.
Yeah, the Iowa Rivers Program is a portion of the Iowa DNR. And Nate Hoogenveen, perhaps a lot of listeners have seen his book, Paddling Iowa, and he's the head of that program. And they work a lot, among other things, on Iowa's water trails. Water trails are just like trails on land, or bike trails, or hiking trails. They're trails that, that follow Iowa's rivers. And they're beginning to be more and more and more of them across the state. We're a state that is very rich in rivers. If you go to the west, they don't have the kinds of rivers that we have in the state. We are rich in streams and rivers. The western third of the state, most of those rivers drain to the Missouri. The eastern two-thirds of the state, those rivers drain to the Mississippi.
It's like our own little continental divide.
It is, as a matter of fact. It's a state divide, and very, very explicit. Everything from, you know, the Des Moines and the Raccoon, those all, even though they go clear into Carroll County, that sort of area, they do drain to the east, and especially to the southeast. I was born and raised down in Burlington and spent the best part of my education, probably, and the best part of my childhood, paddling with my brothers, the rivers of southeastern Iowa, the Des Moines, the Skunk, the Iowa, the Cedar, and the Mississippi itself.
Well, you certainly weren't the only environmentalist to be inspired by that confluence of rivers there.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, I grew up in the same church with Fred Leopold, Aldo's younger brother, and both Aldo and Fred are now buried there in Burlington and Aspen Grove Cemetery. So, yeah, I knew the Leopolds. In fact, one point, I was very fortunate. We borrowed a map from Fred of Big Island. There's a 5-mile-long island in the Mississippi River just south of Burlington, and there are lots of sloughs all the way through there. And we borrowed that map from him. It was a map that he and Aldo had made. And we put tracing paper over it, and we redid it. We showed him and then gave it back to him. We showed him how the sloughs had changed over the years and everything. It was wonderful. But, the rivers have always been a part of my life. So I'm really happy now to be able to go back, on a bunch of rivers that I have been on and many that I have not, in the state, and, get to know them a little more intimately.
Okay. And you mentioned Iowa's water trails.
Right.
And I think that's something that maybe not everybody has thought about, the fact that you just can't put your boat in the river anywhere,
right,
and take a trip, because
right,
you are going to encounter things like dams and just obstacles.
Right, yeah. And in fact, that's part of the Water Trails program, is to try to make these both obvious and safe for people using the rivers. It's a terrific resource we have, and I think Iowa has taken our rivers for granted for so long. If you think about it, Cedar Rapids, Iowa Falls, Iowa, those are all people built towns on the rivers. And they did that because the rivers provided several things. One, they provided power in the form of mills, and many of those dams were built there to provide power that ran a local mill that ground grain for people. Many of those dams later became small hydroelectric facilities. There are very, very few left, but there are some still. And the rivers then also provided transportation. If there weren't overland roads, the river was a mode of transportation. And provided water, obviously, but it also took stuff away. That wonderful thing. It took our waste away. So rivers were those things that we dumped things. We dumped our garbage. We dumped our sewage. Everything went into the river and went away, with no thinking about what might be downstream, another town, another city, lots of other critters, lots of other lives. I think we've, you know, sort of assumed that rivers would always be there and they would always be running just fine. Well, as population has increased and we've become more aware of our surroundings, I think we've realized that we've taken them for granted for far too long. So the Rivers Program is a program that encourages people to get outside, but to do it safely and to do it in a way so that they learn something about the river. My whole focus here this summer has been to help people be intelligent and knowledgeable users of a resource, not just out there using it as a vehicle, but to help them learn something about that resource so that they begin to take care of it. So I'm doing a interpretive and biological survey of the of these rivers.
So what does that look like?
Well, a biological survey, if you think about, gee, you could spend 2 years, 3 years doing a biological survey of just one section to really do a complete job. So it's not intended to be a complete survey. It's a snapshot in time. It's the kinds of things, though, that paddlers might notice as they go down the river. What's the vegetation like along the way? There's a oak forest here. Over here, there's, for example, I was just paddling the upper Iowa, and on many of the north-facing slopes, there's maple basswood forest. Oak trees are up on top. And you say, well, gee, why would that be? Maple basswood is a very shade-tolerant forest, and it's replacing the oak forest that once dominated northeastern Iowa and is not there anymore. Or over here, much of the lowland forest consists in some places basically of silver maple, which is a very big bottomland tree, and often multiple stems.
It sucks up the water.
It sucks up the water and doesn't mind having its roots in the water. Many species don't like that. So what does the forest look like along the way, and why is it there? Why is it absent here? When I was paddling the Little Sioux, is in far northwestern central Iowa, and it's prairie. And so it's a prairie stream, and it's wonderful. You're paddling through prairie, basically. And, here's this river that cuts through the landscape, and you can see the whole landscape around you. It's really quite a wonderful area. And you have to pick the time at which, of course, there's enough water, because there's not always water late in the summer. But this year I've lucked out fairly well. Sometimes we had a little too much, but so what does the forest look like along the way, or the vegetation along the way? Are the banks in good shape? Are they well vegetated, or is the river cutting into them? We think about rivers every few years when they flood us and give us lots of problems. 2008, 2010, 1993, all those 1995. We had a whole series of flood years. In fact, this year we've had floods this summer. I had to get off the Cedar when it began rising with the rains we had a couple of weeks ago because it was flowing way too fast. Big trees were floating down the river. I wasn't going to fight with them. So, and it goes too fast. Yeah, I would like to go slow and see things along the way. So what is the vegetation like? What are the banks like? What kinds of things am I seeing along the way? And everything from bird species to turtles to mussels along the way, and then the plants along the shore. And because I'm a naturalist, basically I integrate all of those things together. I think it's good to be able to help people understand what it is they're seeing. I brought along, I write reports at the ends of the time here, and the reports, I have a certain format that I follow to write up that report, and it's very interpretive in itself. But then I'm also writing for the Water Trails program, the Rivers program. I'm writing a series of sort of, I'm calling them interpretive vignettes about species. And these are things that I think that they can take and then plop right into interpretive signage or interpretive brochures, maybe with a little editing.
A little text box.
Yeah, exactly. So then they run anywhere from, a couple hundred words up to 350, 400 words. So some of them can be a little longer than those. This one, if you allow me, is called To Catch a Fish. Human anglers use all manner of equipment to catch a wily fish. Fiberglass rods, fancy reels, nylon or braided line of just the right weight and color, all manner of lures and baits, even electronic fish finders to make sure they're at the right depth in the water. The belted kingfisher of Iowa rivers uses only two things, its eyes and its mouth, or beak to be more accurate. Those and a lot of patience. You'll see these pigeon-sized, steely blue crested predators sitting on tree branches along the river, waiting silently. They're waiting for a fish to swim by. When they spy one, they fly up, pause briefly midair, and dive after it headfirst into the water. More often than not, they come up with it, too, nabbing it with their beaks. And that's quite a feat when you consider that they must compensate for the light-bending tricks of water to catch a fish. Then they fly from their dive to a nearby perch to consume the fish headfirst. You may see them flying down the river in front of you, perching briefly, then as you approach, flying farther down river again. At some point, they will think they've lured you far enough and often with a noisy rattle fly back upriver to their original perch. Chances are it was either their favorite fishing hole or near their nest in a bank of the river. This they excavate themselves, digging a 3-inch tunnel up to 10 or 12 feet back into the bank. There they lay eggs and raise their young, teaching them to fish with just their beaks and eyes. When you see one, watch quietly and learn why they are indeed the king of fishers. So that's an example of the kind of thing that I'm having fun writing them.
Oh yeah.
It's great fun. And
that's fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
10 feet back.
Yeah, three to 4 meters back into a mud bank. They dig this just using their feet and their beaks. It's pretty amazing. So so there are lots of those kinds of things. I just wrote one the other day about cliff swallows, and cliff swallows are wonderful. They're the ones that people see. They're sort of pottery nests, often under bridges. And if you begin to look, they're mainly under cement bridges because the cement allows the mud to get a purchase enough that it'll hold. Steel bridges don't. If they build them on steel bridges, they're around the bolts that hold the bridge together because that way they can hang on enough. But they have, it takes them 900 to 1200 pellets, in other words, beakful, of mud of just the right kind to put together one nest. So each of those is pretty spectacular.
Are they related to barn swallows?
They are. Well, they're both swallows, and bank swallows are another one, and we have rough-wing swallows, and of course we have purple martins. So we have lots of different swallows in the state.
Oh, I didn't know purple martins were swallows.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. And they all have, it's another thing I've written about too, is different strategies. How barn swallows tend to fly around with their beaks open. And let that be a lesson to you, because if you fly around with your mouth open, you catch insects. You
know? That's right. They catch mosquitoes.
That's right. And mosquitoes and other things, moths and beetles and all kinds of things. And then there's the sit and wait strategy. The kingfishers use a sit and wait strategy, but so do another insect eaters, the kingbirds, eastern kingbirds, great crested flycatchers, and other flycatchers use a sit and wait strategy. Phoebes, peewees, they all use sit and wait. So you have to sit there long enough, something will fly by, and you have to suddenly go out, grab it out of the air, and bring it back to the perch. And so both strategies work, obviously, because we have lots of both swallows that fly around with their mouth open, and kingbirds and other flycatchers that use a sit and wait strategy. So,
okay, so I'll ask you, as a naturalist,
sure.
Trying to find juicy specimens of natural life, do
right.
you use the sit and wait strategy in your canoe, or are you just traveling downstream catching what you can?
I'm doing the traveling downstream catching what I can. Occasionally, I will pull over into a quiet backwater and sit for a while. So I use a little bit of both, but mostly it is because the river is traveling, I'm traveling with it. And me and my little kayak, I use several electronic tools I have strapped to my arm. I use a little digital recorder. When I first started this, I started doing it just by writing, so I'd have to sit and write for a while. And that became very cumbersome, and I couldn't really get many miles done in a day because I would be writing so much. So I've used this digital recorder. I have my camera in my lap, and then I also have a GPS unit along. So I have all of these things going at once, and so I keep track of where I see heronries or rookeries of herons, where I see hawks and owls along the river, and in particular where I see eagles and eagle nests. That's a particular interest to the DNR, and so I'll be giving them all of those locations in these rivers.
Because as we've learned from Bob Anderson, the eagles come back to their nests or reuse their nests year after year.
Yes, they do. And the other kind of interesting thing about it, I've been seeing, for example, 3 and 4 year olds. Eagles don't mature. They don't get that white head and fully white tail until they are 5 years old, approximately, and between their fourth and fifth year. And that's when they can actually sort of begin nesting. If they can find a mate and find an appropriate territory, they begin nesting after, sometime after they're 5 years old. Might be longer than that, but we don't know that for sure. And so seeing a 3 or 4 year old hanging around an area is of interest, because it might be the area where in another year or so we might begin looking for a nest in that area. So I saw, for example, a nest the other day that had 2 fledglings out on the branches around it. One of them, though, had a foot that I think is non-functional. So that bird may not survive. Eagles are doing very, very well. And it's one of those things that I think show us, demonstrate to us, if we as a society make the right decisions, the wildlife can be resilient. And eagles are one of those things that, as a kid growing up in the Mississippi, we used to watch them in the wintertime, because they would come here in the winter. And we had a little blind set up on the Mississippi right by where the cooling station, so it was putting warmer water than the river water, so the river water stayed open all winter long. And so we'd put a blind up, and we'd go crawl into that blind and go watch the eagles as they fished. But as a child, they were almost all adults, because in those years, in the 1950s and 60s, eagle populations were declining rapidly. And it wasn't until 1972, when we banned DDT, that we began to slowly see a recovery of eagles back.
We're talking with Jim Pease, who has an assignment from the Iowa DNR this summer to travel Iowa's river trails and document some of the species and things that you can see along your journey. And your description of how eagles have recovered because of human decisions leads me to my next question, which is, as you travel down the river, do you take note of changes that have been made to the landscape by humans and how humans are affecting the river.
Yeah, I do very much. And that includes everything from overgrazing, the presence of what I would call roadside rubble.
Riprap.
Riprap, right. Well, it's really roadside rubble because in many cases, in most cases, it's just kind of dumped there. It's when we rebuilt roads and bridges and streets before, we needed a place to put that, that big slabs of cement and, you know, chunks and here and there. And gee, we could riprap the river and maybe protect the banks. Well, it does it protect the banks? In some cases, if it is carefully placed, it would. But most cases, it's dumped over the bank and left. And there are also places where we've used cars, where we've used tires, believe it or not, all sorts of things to try to prevent bank erosion. And
really, there are places in Iowa where you see cars along the river bank.
And generally, they're old cars. That's not done anymore, but they're old cars that are piled up in there, refrigerators, all kinds of junk like that. Yeah, it's incredible. So, yeah, I do make note of those and where they need to be cleaned up and that sort of thing. The other thing that I think as Iowans, we need to understand sort of the physics of water and what happens with rivers. During the early part of the last century, we spent a lot of time and money and effort channelizing rivers, straightening them. The Skunk River, we're here in just south of Ames here, was channelized several times. That means that then the land beside it, which is very rich bottom land, could be then be farmed. And that was the whole point of channelizing it. Remove the water quickly from the landscape. We tile it to do that. And then we channelize the river so it goes away quickly. It's that whole away thing. We never quite figure out where away is, but, so but rivers do what rivers do. This is their floodplain. And, as we know here in Ames, the floodplain is frequently reclaimed by the river. When there's enough rain in the watershed upstream, the river rises sometime going over its banks and into its floodplain, which we have tried to claim and put buildings on.
No, that's ours. Roads.
Right, that's right. The river wants it back. And so it's been interesting to me to look at how different towns and cities have handled that, because there are places in the state where that floodplain is actually green space, all green space, and they don't build buildings down there. I find that quite interesting. So,
can you give me an example of
Decorah, for example? Yeah, Decorah. I was just in last week, and from the river, you can't see a building as you're paddling through Decorah because they're set back so far, and the banks are such that you can't really see the buildings at all, and they're not in the floodplain, which is, for the most part, there's one section, sort of in an industrial area where they've decided to build, and there's a Walmart store in the floodplain farther down.
They love the floodplains.
Yeah.
They're like a species that
seem to, yes.
thrive there.
Yes, that's right. So it is, for the most part, the city of Decorah doesn't do that. So it's quite interesting, I think, how we've treated that. And you look at places, Waterloo, Cedar Falls, where as a result of the 2008 flood, they have bought out a lot of the things along the floodplain. So the park has expanded. Black Hawk Park, for example, in Black Hawk County, just north of Waterloo, has doubled or tripled its size because as a result of the FEMA buyouts of land along the river. And so the park has really expanded. So now that's all public land, and they allow it to flood. They allow it to do what rivers do. The physics of water that I started to talk about is that you straighten a river, and once a river cuts down, and many people know how deeply in what we call incised rivers get into land, and they reach that sort of base level, then they have to use up that energy by going sideways, and so they begin to meander again. That's what rivers do. The physics of water are such that It's going to use that energy some way, and since it can't go any lower, it tends to go sideways, so it cuts and begins to meander again. And if you look at historical photos, for example, of the skunk, you can see when it got channelized in the 20s and 30s, and then since then, if you look at photos, aerial photos from the 1950s, 1960s, 1980s, 1990s, today, you see those meanders are getting wider and wider and wider. And that's what rivers do. They expand out across that floodplain. That's a natural result of being a river. And if we understand that, we wouldn't try to engineer them quite so and keep them within their banks so much. We would say, this is not a good place to expect to be able to grow crops every year. This is not a good place to expect to be able to build homes and not have them flooded or carried away. This is not a good place to build a road or a store, a business, because this stuff is going to get ruined every so often. When that is, we don't know for sure.
Another aspect of man-made changes to rivers, of course, is the nutrient levels, and that's received a lot of attention lately. When you paddle a river, can you tell where there is a problem with high nutrient levels? And
yeah, that's a great question. Not directly. Usually you see that more in more quiet bodies of water, lakes and ponds, and you see buildups of such things as duckweed. It's that green two-leaf tiny plant with roots hanging down that goes over the surface of the water, buildup of algae blooms, that sort of thing. Because rivers tend to be moving, at least so far, I don't notice that directly. Sometimes in the backwaters you can see that, but you expect it more in some of the backwaters where it's quiet, it's not carrying the plants away so much. Perhaps, you know, the difficulty with nutrients is that everything needs some nutrients, and so the abundance of fish or the abundance of turtles, the abundance of mussels may be an indicator of sort of the nutrient level in the stream. In other words, if those nutrients are adequate, then you have lots more of those things. But they're only indicators. There's not a one-to-one correspondence because it involves so many other things as well. For mussels, you've got to have not only nutrients but the right minerals and the right substrate. The bottom of the stream has to be proper for them. You have to have the right fish there because of the way mussels develop. So there are a lot of things. One of the examples, for example, I paddled the West Nishnabatna in southwestern Iowa, which is a very channelized stream. And I called it the surprising river because I saw an amazing amount of wildlife along this river. And it may be because it's the only real decent habitat around. It's so heavily agricultural in the area, but I'm not sure that that's the only thing. For example, I saw more soft-shelled turtles there than I've seen on any other river in the state. And I would come around a small bend in the river, and there would be 10 or 12 of them that would go piling off a mud bar or sandbar into the water, stick their little noses up, you know, and look around, what's this? And I was amazed to see that many. So what I don't know is what's the relationship between the nutrients, for example, that you ask about, and the presence of lots and lots of spiny soft shells. Does that mean it's good for them? Is it a matter of the mud bottom more than anything? So I don't really fully understand. Scientists don't fully understand the relationship. So the nutrient levels, no, I haven't been seeing a lot of evidence that, direct evidence of that along the river in the forms of algae blooms and that sort of thing. It's not to say it's not there. I'm just not seeing it.
Right. You just have to go to the USGS website and see what the levels are.
Right. Exactly.
But you mentioned looking at aerial maps from different decades.
Yes.
To look at the rivers. Was that part of this project? Or
no, it's just... not. No, in fact, it's part of, well, I've looked at aerial maps a lot for this project, but not over time. Right. So I haven't looked at the sort of historical data. While I'm interested in some of the history of the river, and I put that into some of the interpretive vignettes that I'm doing, it's usually very specific. For example, if I come to a place, I was doing the Maquoketa, it's a place called Quaker Mill. There's a dam there. And you say, well, gee, why was this called Quaker Mill? So I learned something by asking locals or looking at things that they might have available. I learned a little bit about why it's called what it is. So, and my wife goes along, doesn't paddle with me. She drops me off at an access in the morning and maybe sometimes meets me for lunch, if that's possible, or another access, and picks me up in the evening at an access farther downstream. And meanwhile, during the day, she's actually exploring some of these historical things as well.
Oh, that's cool. That sounds
She has a lot of fun.
That sounds like just a great way to spend your summer.
It is. And we're camping the whole summer. We're tent campers. So we take our dog along and we camp in county and state parks. And we've been having a very good summer.
Well, thank you so much for sharing some of that. Is there anything else you'd like to comment on?
Well, the only thing I'd say is that the goal of this project is to, as I mentioned earlier, is to have not just water users, but intelligent and knowledgeable people who are using the resource that appreciate the resource. And I think we all say, oh, well, I appreciate the river. You know, I look at it every once in a while, you know, that sort of thing. But I think the more you know about it, the more opportunities we give people to learn about our rivers, both how they have impacted our lives as well as how they can daily impact our lives and we impact their lives. I think the better care we will take of the rivers in the future. And I think learning about them is maybe one of those routes to caring.
Well, it sounds like once you have compiled these descriptive, interpretive narratives about the river and your trip down them, it sounds like you could collect them into a book.
Well, I think there may be a book in the offing here. Yes, I'm trying to look at the particularly the vignettes and putting them into a book. I have some interest in that, some folks that are interested in my doing that. I put them together with some other writings that I've done over the years and maybe put one out. So I'm hoping maybe that will happen. So, yes.
And you mentioned another book at the beginning. Could you repeat that?
It's called Paddling in Iowa. It's by Nate Hoogenveen. He's the head of the Iowa Rivers Program in the DNR. A wonderful series of maps and descriptions of river stretches that I think it has 128 different trips in the state that can be taken. And a lot of bookstores have that already, and I think it can be ordered online as well.
Did you pass many other paddlers and tubers on your travels?
Oh, yes, in certain sections, certainly in the upper Iowa tubing, there's a section up there near Kendallville, which is a very popular tubing area.
A different kind of wildlife.
Yes, it's, and I will tell you that I think that if we could educate tubers, that we would solve 90-95% of the beer can problem on the river. They tend to leave behind. And it tends to be two kinds of beer. I wouldn't say I'm a beer connoisseur, but I appreciate good beer. And this is not good beer. It's what a lot of people refer to as lawnmower beer.
Let me guess, Coors and Bud?
No, Bud Light and Busch Light. That makes up 90%+ of the cans that I pick up along the way. Yeah,
it's fascinating.
So, yeah, it is.
I think that deserves a vignette.
Yes, it probably will be.
Okay, well, thank you, Jim. It was really a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Jim Pease, a retired Extension Wildlife Specialist after 24 years of service and Emeritus Professor at Iowa State University. This is an edition of a series we're calling Clean Water Radio on KHOI Community Radio, focusing on this resource that, as Jim says, we are so very rich in. Next up, my interview with Rob Bolke of Roland, originally of Dayton, Iowa, known to his friends for cajoling them onto Iowa's rivers and showing them a fabulous time.
I had a group of friends who weren't really into competitive sports. It's like I would be out on the baseball diamond in the middle of summer thinking, what am I doing out here? I'm hot, I'm dirty, I'm not really enjoying this. So we would take off and go hike in the woods or go down to the river. We would do the usual things. We would go swimming when we weren't supposed to. My best friend had an old beat-up canoe that his father and grandfather had made for fishing trips up to Minnesota. His grandfather owned a heating and cooling shop in Des Moines, and they had figured out how to successfully weld aluminum. So they built three 17 or 18 foot long canoes back in the probably 40s, and one of them had gone home with my best friend's father and was always kind of out in the weeds behind his barn. So we started dragging that out and kind of just kept doing it. We probably started when we were 10 years old. There was a pond near his house that we would go paddle around on, but we outgrew that pretty quick. It was a small pond. And we were always into camping and backpacking, even at that age. So we talked our parents one time into letting us take a canoe trip. And we had a list of things we promised to do and not do, and kind of formally presented it to them, and they just kind of said, okay, it looks like you guys have thought about this, go ahead. And it was a 2-week canoe trip down the Des Moines River from Fort Dodge all the way down to the fairly new at that time Sailorville Dam. Now we were, I suppose we were 11, 12, 13 years old, so I suppose it was 1975. There weren't a lot of boat ramps. There was certainly no signage, you know, kind of a hairy thing to send your kids off to do. But like I said, we had been out camping quite a bit. We had thrown together some gear and kind of proven ourselves responsible. So they let us do it. Changed our lives. We're both still paddling 40 years later, you know. The most prevalent memory is of sand. Sand in everything. Every bite of food, every bit of clothing. We were just a couple rough-and-tumble kids. We had garbage bags. We didn't have dry bags. There wasn't really that kind of equipment back then. We camped on sandbars, private land. There weren't really any campgrounds along the way. We just kind of paddled until we were tired and put up camp. And we got approached by people a couple of times, you know, kind of, hey, what are you kids doing out here? And, you know, do your parents know where you are? You can't be out here. Well, we explained to them that, you know, This was the deal. We were on a 2-week trip. It was fine by our parents. It was kind of funny. My father was a hog buyer for Hormel's, and so he knew everybody up and down the river valley. So I suspect there were frequent reports getting back to our parents about where we were at. And two or three times during that trip, my father would appear on a bridge overpass with a couple of bags of groceries. So I don't think we were too far out of sight for too long.
With every stroke, we're closer to the bay. The weight of the world is falling away. An autumn wind is tugging at my sleeve. I know it's time to go, but I don't want to leave.
Exactly how far were you from the river there in Dayton, Iowa?
Well, we had, back then, we had the old railroad tracks that ran through town, and there still were trains about once a week back in the mid-70s. So you could walk, I think there were four or five trestles down to the river, you know, bridges over creeks. And on a good day, you could make it down to the river in an hour if you took the tracks. And quicker if you hopped on a train, although I wouldn't advocate doing that. It might have happened a time or two, though. And if you're really ambitious, you could take the tracks all the way across the river into Stratford, because that's where the pretty girls were in our minds.
Battles in the water.
When you're on the river now as an adult, what kind of things are you looking at or looking for?
I love the relaxation of it. That's the main thing. It's a lot of work hauling canoes around, getting gear together, coolers, corralling your friends, getting to the meetup points, the put-ins. But man, the second you get on that water, it all disappears. Everybody just kicks back, you know. Recent years in Iowa, there's been eagle nests along the rivers, which is always a highlight. There's so many different varieties of birds, mammals. Lately, you see, a lot of beaver, but you'll see muskrat. River otters are always exciting to see. One time on the Current River, which is in Missouri, we ran across a band of wild horses that were all white. Didn't know they were there, but it turns out it's kind of a familiar sight on that river, and they followed us for about 20 miles. You know, we kept seeing them in different places. Just gorgeous. You know, what a treat in the Midwest to see something like that.
Could you talk a little bit about Iowa's rivers? How have they changed since when you were growing up? And what are the special features about them that, besides their being close at hand, that we should value?
Well, paddling has obviously increased in popularity hugely, hugely over the last 20 years. Nate Hoogeveen wrote a book called Paddling Iowa that has become everybody's go-to book. And he basically lists all the rivers in Iowa and the put-ins, takeouts, the times, geography, history. It's a fantastic book and a great resource. Also, local groups have been doing great work in getting signage on rivers, boat ramps and takeouts. A lot of volunteer groups really improve the put-ins and takeouts, especially in central Iowa. Skunk River Paddlers are one group that's very, very active. The rivers are notably cleaner, garbage-wise. You do see fewer tires. There's river cleanups that groups go out on. When we paddled the Des Moines River on that two-week trip, there were still meatpacking plants in Fort Dodge dumping right into the river. It wasn't good. I mean, it was kind of nasty. It got better as we went down, and other creeks flowed in. And I say better and worse. If you paddle now, you will see erosion everywhere. Farmers will plow right up to the banks. The CRP money has basically been outweighed by the price of grain. So farmers are farming every inch of land they can. We have some buffer zones around Bear Creek and Roland, and when you see what that does to the water quality, it's amazing. You know, 50 yards of buffer zone on either side of a river or creek is a great thing, and it's an easy thing to do, but it's tough to get farmers to buy into that because it costs them money. They're making money when they're planting corn, but look at the bigger picture. They're losing their land. I mean, the erosion this year with the rain was stunning. It was stunning. We were out in March, and there were just rivers of black mud running off the fields. And I've been paddling in Iowa in every month of the year, and it's shocking what you'll see. Iowa's beautiful topsoil just running downstream. It's like rain on my face, and there are tears in your eyes. Knee deep in the river of mud. We have an annual paddling trip that my family participates in, and we usually, I think this is what you were on with us, we usually have maybe 20 boats, canoes and kayaks, and we do it over Memorial Day weekend every year. Well, last year it rained for 3 days over Memorial Day weekend, and if you remember, it basically didn't rain again the rest of the summer. We couldn't paddle that weekend. We did it, you know, a month later as rivers were on their way down, but then basically didn't get out again the rest of the year. With the exception of the Des Moines River, there's usually a channel on that you can paddle most of the year, even in the driest. That's the river I grew up on. I love that river. It's got great sandbars. But we also really like the Iowa River and the Boone River, much smaller rivers. Fantastic when the water is flowing. The Iowa River's somewhat spring-fed, so much cleaner water, rock bottom, gorgeous river. Nice put-ins and take-outs every 2 hours or so, but you know, in dry years, there's just sections you'll never get down without getting out and dragging your canoe, and that's a bit tedious. The Boone River is the one other river we paddled a lot growing up. Again, a fantastic river, very scenic, very little development along it for the most part. We paddled mostly from Webster City all the way down to the mouth. It's called the mouth of the Boone, where it runs into the Des Moines River, which is near between Dayton and Stratford. Beautiful spot. If you've never been there, it's worth checking out just to see the confluence of these two rivers.
The Boone and the Des Moines.
The Boone runs into the Des Moines right there. And there's, depending on the water level, there's usually a half mile of sandbar at the end of the Boone leading down to a big sandbar on the Des Moines. So it's a very popular fishing spot, and you know, people will go ride motorcycles out there in the sand and things like that. But it's a beautiful, beautiful spot. There was a series of Indian mounds overlooking that spot in what is now Vigor Cemetery. They didn't know it was an Indian mounds when the white people came along and decided they were going to turn that into a cemetery. And when they did find that out, they dug the bones up and relocated them into a central spot in the cemetery. There's a marker there, but you can still see the mounds. And it's just a stunning overlook of the confluence of the rivers. One of my favorite spots in the world.
Wow. And, of course, the Des Moines River is known for its very steep slopes and deep channel. Very picturesque.
Oh, it's gorgeous. It's a beautiful river. Huge, huge river valley. And there are really nice gravel roads leading up a lot of that river. There are old cruising roads, you know, spent a lot of time driving up and down the rivers there. You can drive from, you know, Dayton all the way up through Fraser and Boone on gravel roads that follow the river. It's gorgeous, and a lot of people do it just for recreational purposes. It's a beautiful, beautiful drive.
Do you see a lot of people out when you're canoeing?
On the river?
Yeah.
More and more, yeah. You'll see a lot of pickup trucks or, you know, canoe trailers sitting at put-ins, and a lot of times you'll run across those people if they haven't been on the water too long. And, you know, it's always fun to stop and talk to them. Okay, often you'll see people on sandbars. You know, they stop along there and build a fire and roast some hot dogs or something, and, you know, it's always fun to stop and see who they are, what they're up to, where they put in, where they're going. Everybody has a story on the river. You know, they're there for a different reason. Some people, it's their first time. Some people do it every weekend. There's a lot of green belt along rivers now. A lot of the Iowa River Valley is public land, which means there's good timber.
And your brother lives out there, so you're down there a bit.
Well, this is the Iowa River up near from Iowa Falls on down to Eldora.
Oh, okay.
That's one of our favorite paddling spots. The Iowa River down along Iowa City is not nearly as scenic. The Cedar River over there is a very nice river. if we go paddle over there, it's usually on the Cedar or the Wapsipinicon River. There's a lot of rivers in Iowa. That's the other thing. There's such a variety. If you go up to Northeast Iowa, the Upper Iowa is nationally renowned as a beautiful scenic river, 600-foot high bluffs along there. You know, you'll see perching eagles up on the bluffs, lots of pine stands. There's the Turkey, Volga, and Yellow Rivers up there, all fantastic rivers. They run crazy directions up there because it's, you know, hilly and near the Mississippi River. You can paddle the backwaters of the Mississippi as well. We've done that several times up near Wisconsin and Minnesota. And you can just get so lost back in the back channels there. And until a barge goes by, you're not even sure where the river is sometimes. But it's absolutely beautiful. One year we were up there paddling, and there's a heron rookery where herons nest and mate and raise their young. And there are over 1,000 heron nests. And I don't know if you've ever seen a heron nest up close, but they're these spindly little nests made of twigs, and they'll put 15 or 20 of them in a tree. So there's, you know, 30 adult birds up in the tops of these trees with young hatchlings kind of flapping around the nests, and everything's kind of moving and swaying around, and it just looks like the whole thing's a, you know, a stack of cards. But there's 1,000 nests up there. They've been there for decades. And there are heron rookeries along the Skunk River. I know of a couple along there. The Skunk River, we haven't even talked about, also a very nice river when there's water. It gets a little hairy sometimes. There's log jams that you'll need to portage around. And you know, a year like this year with lots of rain, things change. Things change pretty quickly on the river, so you need to be aware. You come around a corner, you're not necessarily sure what you're going to find. I've had friends get in trouble, get stuck under a log. You know, it's you need to be prepared, but most of the rivers around here, we have a saying before we start a canoe trip, if you get in trouble, if you dump, the first thing you do is stand up. You can probably stand up in most of the rivers here.
Anything else you'd like to say?
Well, I obviously get a lot of enjoyment out of paddling. It's a fantastic, inexpensive way to get out and really appreciate what Iowa has to offer. You know, I love going to Colorado as much as the next person. I have a lot of family out there. But there's a lot here in Iowa that people, if they took the time, they would find out that it's really a beautiful state. The rivers here are fantastic. I get out every chance I can get. Sometimes it's every weekend. Sometimes it's not as often, unfortunately. You know, everybody gets busy. But because of the popularity of paddling sports, you know, we have several good stores around here. Check Craigslist. You can find great deals on kayaks. Don't go to one of the big discount stores and buy one of their $200 kayaks. You're not going to be happy in a boat like that. Spend that same money on a used kayak. You'll be thrilled with it. You're going to get a better boat. It's accessible. It's cheap. A couple dry bags will cost you $15 a piece. You know, paddles are $15 a piece, and you don't need much more than that when it comes down to it. Life jackets, you know, a throw, and you're set for a day on the river. It's a lot of fun for not much money. And, you know, once you get a boat, if you buy an aluminum canoe, you'll have it for life.
Well, thank you so much, Rob. I really appreciate your passion for canoeing and for the rivers of Iowa. And I'll see you out on the river again soon.
Sounds great. We're heading out in a week or two. Thanks, Greta.
That's all we have time for today. You've been listening to Clean Water Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. This is a special series we're doing on Local Talk on Fridays. Tune in next week. We'll be discussing hog confinement operations, in particular a confinement that's going in southern Boone County that neighbors feel is much too close to the swimming hole that the Boy Scouts use. Our guests today were Jim Pease, retired Extension Wildlife Specialist who is documenting the water trails of Iowa in his kayak. And that last guest was Rob Bulkey of Roland, Iowa. Links to the book that kept coming up, Paddling Iowa, and to the Iowa River Trails will be on our KHOI website, khoifm.org. You can also listen to this show or share it with a friend. Richard Morrison engineered the show, and our theme song is Backtrackin'. from The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard some other music. That Paddles in the Water song was by Shirley Eichard, and we heard River of Mud by a rather eccentric performer there. His name is Stuart Wild. As always, your participation as listener is what makes this show possible. Thank you so much for listening, and see you again on the radio.